You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is Premium Episode 1, Farm Bustouts and the Chickenization of America. Today I'm recording from Des Moines, Iowa, and this episode is brought to you by Tyson Foods, powered by Tyson. So right up front, I just wanted to thank you for subscribing, very first episode. It means a lot to me. Thank you very much. Let's get into the show. So, relatively early on in The Sopranos, in Season 2, Episode 10, a character named Davey Scatino, who's a friend of Artie Bucco and Tony Soprano, he's the guy who ran the local sporting goods store. He was playing poker with the boys and fell into, and then chose to play in the high-stakes game, and fell into debt to the tune of $53,000 with a weekly VIG. In the course of this plot, Tony Soprano takes over the sporting goods business and also takes Davey's car, giving it to Meadow. It's a whole subplot, right? Then Tony Soprano and Richie Aprile run a bust-out scheme on the sporting goods store. Now, a bust-out scheme is when a business's assets and line of credit are exploited and exhausted to the point of insolvency. Usually this leads to bankruptcy, but the point of the bust-out scheme is that the mafia, or whoever runs the scheme, gets more value out of running the business into the ground than they would have made by running the business, right?
He told me not to get in the game. Why'd you let me do it?
Well, I knew you had this business here, Davey. It's my nature. Frog and the scorpion, you know? Now, besides, if you would have won, I'd be the one crying the blues, right?
What's the end?
The end? It's planned bankruptcy. Hey, you're not the first guy to get busted out. This is how a guy like me makes a living. This is my bread and butter. When this is over, you're free to go. You can go anywhere you want. Oh, for Christ's sake.
Bust-out schemes are an old mafia tactic, and the scheme goes back about as long as lines of credit have existed and business owners could fall into debt with organized crime. For you, the elect, the premium listeners, it probably won't come as a surprise to you if I say that private equity firms also engage in bust-out schemes, right? Like Bain Capital, for instance. Now, of course, this is not my theory alone. Many, many people have observed and made this argument, right? And there's a host of reasons why private equity firms do bust-out schemes, ranging from it's just an efficient way to extract surplus value, all the way to there are literally organized crime figures involved in these private equity firms. The answer is both, right? But if we do a galaxy brain and take it to the next level, some people have postulated that the 2008 financial crisis was a type of bust out as well. I would argue, and again I'm not alone in arguing this, that the savings and loan crisis of the 80s and 90s was another bust out scheme. But today, I would like to talk about a bust out scheme that does not get talked about enough, which is to say, the bust out of America's farmers, how it ties into the growth of agribusiness, how it ties into financialization of everything, how it ties into environmental degradation, and animal abuses. Let's get into it. If you've been associated with radical left politics for any length of time, at least in the US, Australia, Europe, and so on, chances are you've interacted with animal rights activists, whether in person or online, and just about everybody has interacted with PETA, right? Whether in person or online, these people are usually vegan, right? And more often than not, they might show or share videos showing off the conditions of industrial factory farming. These videos are usually taken covertly and illegally, which raises all sorts of legal questions, right? Now there's one that's stuck in my head that shows little baby chicks being ground up, which is a process known as maceration, because there's no use for male chicks, right? Then there's countless other videos showing chickens, cows, and pigs being kept in awful conditions on their way to our dinner tables. Usually there might also be some videos of monkeys or primates being experimented on, and then maybe, you know, some videos of cosmetics testing as well. Now, it might not matter to an animal whether their slaughterhouse was pre-industrial or industrial, but there's no way to get around the fact that raising so many animals in these conditions has led to a deleterious effect on the environment, as well as our diets and health. There's all kinds of examples of why. Food poisoning rates have gone up with mass industrial factory farming, superbugs are created, everyone's eating way too much meat, and so on, right? Now, I'm saying all this not to preach to you, dear listener. I believe that most of us have already been confronted with this evidence and have acted accordingly, whether that's to accept these crimes or to go vegan. For the record, I'm not vegan, but I am very sympathetic. If you want to hear more on this topic, I would recommend the book Animal Liberation by Peter Singer. Otherwise, I'm not going to dwell on these points, but I do think they're important. Now, in a lot of ways, I think the history of humanity is the history of farming, and farming advances laid the groundwork for industrialization in the first place, which then underwent several waves of industrialization itself. Many of these waves of industrialization were ruinous and had massive body counts, which is true of every type of industrialization just about everywhere. One particularly important trend, which was mechanization of agriculture, has led to continuously fewer and fewer people engaged in agriculture and agricultural production and support-related professions. Like, it used to be that the majority of a society needed to be farming to sustain itself, right? And now we have just ridiculously small amounts of people, relatively speaking, doing the farming for the rest of society. In a lot of ways, this is good, but of course there are downsides. But there are other trends that are also kind of a problem, like farm diversification has also fallen off, which is bad because farm diversification, which is to say, not growing just one crop, but growing, you know, growing different things in different seasons and having different animals, small amounts of different animals. In a lot of ways, farm diversification was like a shock absorber, both to the farm and to the land itself. Because if the main crop you're growing, if the prices just fall off a cliff, then maybe you can get by with some of the animal byproduct, with some of the animals you're raising, and at least, you know, make it through to the next season. But farms are increasingly just not diversifying, right? And all of these trends are happening at the same time. From the 1950s on, in the United States anyway, big business and finance has pushed its way into agriculture. No less than Ezra Taft Benson, who was Eisenhower's Secretary of Agriculture, and would later be the president of the Mormon Church, Ezra Taft Benson urged farmers to get big or get out. What I didn't know, until I researched it anyway, was that mass industrial animal factory farming was inextricably tied to the financialization of farming. Now, this fact may not be shocking to some people, but when I found it out, I thought it was super interesting. And to explain that, I have to talk about the Vesti family. The Vesti family is one of the richest families in the United Kingdom. At least, they are one of the richest families that we know about in the United Kingdom. I think that there is what you might call, like, subterranean wealth hidden away, but we know that the Vestis are extremely wealthy. In the 1940s, it was estimated that they were the second richest family in the United Kingdom after the royal family, for reference. So the Vestis come to modern prominence with Edmund and William Vesti, who founded the Union Cold Storage Company in Liverpool, England in 1897. They went on to become meat monopolists, and they would have gigantic cattle ranches in South America. They would also have major holdings in Australia, I think South Africa too, really all over the world. But their initial main holdings were in Argentina, and then selling that meat in the United Kingdom. They got pretty close to monopolizing all beef in the United Kingdom. Their meat packing cartel in Argentina had such a crippling effect on the Argentine labor movement and early economic development that it led almost directly to the formation of militant labor organizations that pushed Perón into power, which then led to the subsequent dictatorship of the generals, the terrorism, the Falklands War, and the country's economic disasters. The Vesti family was involved in all of those events. So the Vesti brothers were early exploiters of gaps in the international tax system. William Vesti testified before an official commission in the United Kingdom saying, "If I kill a beast in the Argentine and sell the product of that beast in Spain, this country, which is to say the United Kingdom, can get no tax on that business. You may do what you like, but you cannot have it." Unquote. Because that's an interesting question, right? The Vesti brothers were British citizens, but they were doing business all over the world. And as a hypothetical, if cattle is raised and even slaughtered in Argentina, then shipped and sold in the United Kingdom, where exactly is the profit made? And where should it be taxed? Turns out, these questions are more negotiable than you would think. The Vestis brought two complicating factors into the mix. First, they owned the shipping companies that would transfer the meat in the first place. And with those shipping companies, they made sure that shipping rates and other steps in the supply chain would eat up most of the profits that would have belonged to either the Argentine ranching concerns or the UK retail businesses. Second, they put all of these companies under the shroud of a trust in Paris. Now, there's so much to trusts. They are so interesting to me. And some of you might know about them already, but I am going to operate off the theory that most of you might not know this. And if not, you know, you can skip ahead. But even if you know what a trust is, you might not know how it can be used to avoid taxes, right? Let's get into it. So basically, a trust is when you would hand your assets over to others to manage, but you pick the people who manage these assets, and the people you pick let you do whatever you want with the assets. It sounds like sophistry or something, but it's literally not more complex than that. I quote from Nicholas Shaxson, a financial journalist, who describes trusts. "What a trust does, at heart, is to manipulate the ownership of an asset. You might think ownership is a simple thing. You have, say, $1 million in the bank. You own it, you can save it, you can spend it, you can take it out in $10 bills and put it in your bathtub. But ownership can, in fact, be unbundled into separate strands. This happens, for example, when you buy a house with a mortgage. Until you repay the loan, the bank has some ownership rights over your house, and you have other rights. A trust unbundles ownership into different parts very carefully. When a trust is set up, the original owner of an asset, in theory, gives it away into a trust. The trustee becomes the legal owner of the asset, although this person is not free to spend or consume it, for they must legally obey the terms of the trust deed, the instructions that tell them exactly how to share out the benefits to the beneficiaries. The trustee must obey these instructions, and apart from fees, he or she may not receive any of the benefits. So a rich old man with two children might put $5 million into a bank account owned by a trust, and then appoint a reputable lawyer as the trustee, instructing him that when the son is 21, he should receive half the money, and when the daughter becomes 21, she should get the rest. Even if the wealthy man dies before the money is paid out, the trust will survive, and the trustee is bound in law to pay out the money as he is told. It is very hard indeed to break a trust. Now imagine the assets in a trust are shares in a company. The company may register the trustee, the legal owner, but it will not register the beneficiaries, the people who will be getting and enjoying the money. It won't register these beneficiaries anywhere. If you have $1 million in an offshore trust in the Bahamas and the tax inspectors come after you, it will be hard for them to even start their inquiries. Trust instruments in the Bahamas are in no official register. Even if the tax inspectors or police get lucky and find out the identity of a trustee, that is simply to be that is likely to be simply a Bahamas lawyer who does this for a living, who may be the trustee for thousands of trusts. He or she may be the only person in the world who knows you are the beneficiary, and he or she is bound by professional confidentiality to keep your secret safe. In this case, the tax inspector would hit a stone wall. You can make this secrecy deeper still, of course, by layering one secrecy structure on another. The assets in the Jersey Trust may be $1 million in a bank in Panama, itself protected by strong bank secrecy. Even under torture, the Bahamas lawyer could never reveal the beneficiary because he or she wouldn't know. Such intermediaries merely send the checks to some lawyer somewhere else who is also not the beneficiary. You can keep this going, layering the Jersey Trust on another trust in the Caymans, itself perched on a secret company structure in Nevada. If Interpol comes looking, they must go through difficult, slow, and costly court procedures in country after country and must face the flee causes that mean the asset automatically hops elsewhere at the first sign of investigation. The Vesties set up a trust in Paris using the British lawyers Hall and Sterling, and it was relatively simple compared to the shell games that are run today. Still, it took Britain's inland revenue, which is to say their IRS, it took them 8 years to know that this trust even existed. Trusts don't just provide secrecy, they also help you evade taxes or hide money, or, you know, illicit funds, criminal funds. Trusts make it look like you've given your assets away while you actually retain control of them. Only your trust lawyer would know the truth, and they are always well compensated to keep their mouths shut. And that's exactly what the Vestey brothers did. They leased their overseas businesses to Union Cold Storage Limited, a company based in the UK, which would normally have had to pay rent to the Vesties, except this rent was paid to their trust, thereby avoiding taxes. This made it look like they had very little to no taxable income, but they retained control. Now, depending on your background, dear listener, this might seem pedestrian, because it's fairly common now, or this also might be wild news to you. I think it's fascinating either way, because the Vestey brothers found ways to pay almost nothing in taxes anywhere. For the record, two things as well. When people complain about trust fund kids, this is of course what we're talking about. These are trusts. And then, in the United States, when we talk about trust busting and antitrust action, this is also what we're talking about. Standard Oil developed the use of a business trust in order to horizontally and vertically expand in what was later determined to be illegal ways, right? So now antitrust is almost synonymous with anti-monopoly or something, right? But let's keep moving. Now, the Vestey brothers found ways to pay almost nothing in taxes, and consequently, they basically fought a war for decades with the British tax authorities. One tax officer said, "Trying to come to grips with the Vesties over taxes like trying to squeeze a rice pudding." In 1980, during one of these fights with British Inland Revenue, an investigation done by the Sunday Times revealed that the Vesties, in 1978, the Vesties Dewhurst chain of butchers in Britain had paid £10 on a profit of more than 2.3 million, which is to say a tax rate of 0.0004%. The newspaper said, "Here is an immensely wealthy dynasty which for more than 60 years has paid trivial sums in tax. All that time, its members have enjoyed the considerable pleasures of being rich in England without contributing anything near their fair share to the defenses which kept those pleasures in being, against foreign enemies in wartime, against disorder and disease in times of peace." Which, I mean, yeah, pretty much, they just didn't pay taxes. And that is precisely how they do it. And when other rich people don't pay taxes, they are also using trusts to get around it. Now, we talked about the Vestey brothers, but now we have to talk about John Tyson of Tyson Chicken. So John Tyson was born in 1905 and he died in 1967. He was the founder of Tyson Foods, right? This John Tyson, the first Tyson, he invented a process that is now called the Great Chickenization. In his life, he basically assembled a chicken empire. He would make exclusive supply agreements with farmers. He would give them the chicks. He would send them vitamin-enriched feed. He would help them set up incubators. And later on, he would offer credit to farmers to build the chicken houses in the first place. And Tyson would buy up feed mills and hatcheries, pretty much expanding in every direction, horizontal and vertical, right? Now, Tyson Feed and Hatchery, which was the first company, was formally incorporated in 1947. They would go on to make deals with supermarkets and fast food outlets, and they would go on to make advances in chicken raising, breeding, all these techniques. Most importantly, though, they hired an accountant from the Vesti brothers. This accountant knew that a vertically integrated company from farmer to transporter to consumer means that you can make even more money in the twists and turns of the supply chain at every step, just like the Vesti brothers. The Tysons set up a shell company operation to help them shift profits around their empire, and for example, in the year 1985, these shell companies helped save them $27 million in taxes. And their larger and larger size helped them mine another large seam of profit. During cycles of boom and bust, its fortress balance sheet would allow it to buy up the flotsam from bankrupt competitors very cheaply. And there was one further trick that the accountant insisted on. Tyson should own as many parts of the supply chain as possible. All except for the chicken houses. This is for several reasons. First, owning the chicken houses would have unnecessarily expanded the balance sheets of Tyson, tying up capital and thereby lowering return on equity and other financial ratios. There was also the question of possible future environmental liability, what with all the pollution that industrial animal farming causes. But the most important reason why Tyson didn't want to raise chickens themselves is because they wanted to shunt the risk onto the farmers. These farmers were over the barrel in dealing with the Tyson juggernaut. Now, this is basically a huge scam, because in these contracts that these chicken farmers would sign with Tyson, the chicken farmers could not sell to anyone but Tyson. But the chicken farmers were liable for all of the risks, not Tyson. Any instances of mass chicken deaths, for example, which is not uncommon, you know, it's a possibility in mass industrial factory chicken farming, all of this would have to come out of the chicken farmers' end, and they were barely making any profits in the first place. These chicken farmers would be squeezed in every part of their contracts. In the book The Meat Racket, the author of the book heard instructions directly from a Tyson field technician. Go out there and piss the farmer off. Then he reported another Tyson employee saying if anything went wrong, they were to blame the farmer for it. Mistakes could never be admitted. First, Tyson got local farmers in Iowa and other states into these usurious deals. Eventually, the local farmers would not or could not sign up to run their chicken farms. They knew what would happen. Then, Tyson preyed on Laotian immigrant families, convincing them to take over these operations, providing them funding, and then squeezing them to death. Now, owning every step of the process except for the chicken farms, this is basically the same model as Uber, which is to say owning everything except the cars. Or, you know, employing the drivers as employees, right? It's basically a financial trick to shift the liability and the assets onto someone else, but to then suck out the profit. Even worse, Tyson set up a secretive internal competitive tournament that set farmer against farmer, constantly telling them they were in danger of falling behind, manipulating the prices paid, and shifting more risk onto their shoulders. An invisible force hung over their farms, steadily driving down their paychecks each month, which created a new breed of high-tech sharecroppers who lived on the ragged edge of bankruptcy. Do you remember in episode 8 of Program to Chill? We talked about Henry Ford and how he screwed over his own franchisees, making them take on a bunch of debt. Screwing your franchisees, a tried and true American tradition. Chickenization techniques spread to the beef industry pretty early on. Hogs, however, took longer to chickenize because they were more susceptible to diseases. It wasn't until the 1980s that they solved this problem by massively dosing pigs with antibiotics. And of course, chickenization accounting methods spread to the beef and pork industries as well. Now, chickenization, which is a synonym for mass industrial factory farming of animals, this necessarily leads to CAFOs, which is to say concentrated animal feeding operations. This is when you might have, say, 6,000 pigs living in one barn. Now, the environmental impact of CAFOs are insane. The standard CAFO for pigs is 2,500 pigs in one barn, right? Now, a CAFO might be operated by like just 2 to 3 low-level day laborers, sometimes called hog house janitors, because basically all they do is to press the feed button, haul out any dead pigs, and refill feed machines. There's really no technical expertise needed. CAFOs have pigs in densely packed pens, never seeing sunlight or fresh air. They get fed special mixtures of feed mixed with antibiotics. Conditions like these lead to superbug spreading, like MRSA. Unlike when you raise animals normally, these pigs don't give you dung that you could use in normal farming. Under these conditions and under that diet, they basically create only diarrhea. No, pig CAFOs give you hydrogen sulfide, ammonium bisulfate, dimethyl sulfide, methane, and nitrous oxide. All of these are toxic and noxious biochemicals and gases. These pigs are not giving off manure, they're giving off raw sewage equivalent to a town of 8 to 10,000 people. If you drive near a pig CAFO, you would smell a astringent chemical burn smell that sears your nostrils. And if you had the misfortune of falling into a bubbling pit of pig sewage, you would literally die. Pig sewage has impaired large numbers of Iowa's water bodies and rivers, and agricultural toxins flow into the Atlantic Ocean and have caused a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, approximately the size of New Jersey. CAFOs lower home property values due to their unpleasantness and health risks. Consequently, in the areas around CAFOs, there are more meth labs whose smells are masked by the CAFO stenches, and, ironically, also more pedophiles, who, as a class, are generally forced to live in cheaper areas and places where there are fewer children. So chickenization, basically a synonym for mass industrial factory farming, it's bad. It's bad for the animals, it's bad for the farmers, it's bad for the environment. Who exactly is it good for? To answer that, we gotta look at the farm bust-out scheme. In 1972, the United States made a gargantuan trade deal to export grain to the Soviet Union. This soaked up all of America's excess grain supplies within 2 years, which caused wheat prices to double and corn prices to triple. Euro markets were rising, and the Bretton Woods system was collapsing. This meant that vast swaths of credit were now available to farmers, who, seeing the prices go up, these farmers borrowed to invest and grow their farms to match this larger market demand, right? Looked like a sure thing, right? There was a lot of optimism at this time. People thought they were going into a golden age of agriculture. John Eichard, professor at the University of Missouri and a well-known agricultural economist, said, "We were going to improve the efficiency of agriculture, bring down the cost of production, and deliver food security by making food affordable for everyone." The basic approach, which had been adopted in industry after industry, was to industrialize, specialize, and standardize, and move into and consolidate into larger operations. We moved away from the traditional idea of the family farm as a way of life, and it became a business. Then came the Volcker Shock in 1980, when interest rates were raised. As a reminder, the Volcker Shock was a rapid rise in interest rates that then caused recessions in 1981 and 1982. This was named after Paul Volcker, who was the chair of the Federal Reserve. Right, he was appointed by Nixon and he served through Jimmy Carter's administration into Reagan's. Now, in preparation for this episode, I pulled up some information about the Volcker Shock. Now, what I'm looking at here is a description of the Volcker Shock by the Nelson A. Rockefeller Center for Public Policy and the Social Sciences at Dartmouth, which, lol. And they are having a Chicago ghoul saying that the Volcker Shock induced a sharp recession that just purges all sorts of unprofitable fixed capital and a shift of capital investment into financial forms. Which, I gotta say, not inaccurate. It certainly did shift capital into financial forms. That's one way to put it. To the farmers, though, it was basically just squeezing them. Then, supposedly in response to the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, in 1980, President Carter signed a trade embargo against the grain deals with the Soviet Union. This caused the prices of grain to collapse. On top of that, there was a severe drought. I believe that drought was in 1983. By 1984, farm debt was up 15 times what it was in the 1950s. Which I say because that's more or less before big business had really started to move into the agricultural sector, directly anyway. Farm outputs were way higher than in the 1950s, but farm incomes were just one-third of the incomes that they were getting in the 1950s. This is more or less directly due to the debt, right? They were getting squeezed, and it caused widespread farm bankruptcies all over the country. And guess who moved against the family farmers who went out of business? Big business and the banks, of course. As a side note, and this is a topic that I plan to get into in the future, this is the period of time when the Posse Comitatus movement, as well as the militias and the sovereign citizen movements, were spreading like a wildfire among farming communities. Those three movements had antecedents, but it was during this period that it was really taking off. Many of these movements, in turn, were both scams on farmers, and they were also infiltrated and arguably controlled by the feds. In other words, farmers were tricked into taking large amounts of debt, then the government caused the markets to crash, then many farmers lost everything, and the government then made sure that their forms of protest and resistance did not pose a serious challenge. This was a bust-out, in other words, but not by Tony Soprano, but by the banks with the help of the government. Another tragic farce is the role of central planning in raising these animals. So, as late as 1992, 90% of hogs were sold on the open market. Today, upwards of 95% of all hogs are sold in closed transactions. Quoting John Eichard, "Now you have those large corporations making the decisions. They can stabilize the supply of product into the market at a level that is profitable in a market that is concentrated and centrally controlled. People brag about the free market economy, but we have central planning here, just not by the government. It's central planning by corporations." Unquote. Basically, agriculture is run on monopoly and central planning, not according to free market economics, right? Even more curious, there's this organization, using Iowa as a case study, mind you, there's this organization in Iowa called the Iowa Farming Bureau. It describes itself as a grassroots organization that's a voice for rural farmers. It's a tax-exempt corporation. It does lobbying, but its core function is to provide insurance. The Iowa Farm Bureau owns 59% of a New York Stock Exchange-listed company called FBL Financial Group. The other 41% of FBL Financial Group is owned by the following owners: BlackRock, Vanguard, Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, Bank of America, UBS, Barclays, and various other hedge funds. FBL Financial Group and its subsidiaries own $8.8 billion in assets as of 2016, with revenues of $1.1 billion. This comes mostly from insurance and investment holdings. This is what passes itself off as a voice for Iowa's farmers, the most Wall Street entity imaginable. The Iowa Farm Bureau, it goes without saying, has a huge amount of political clout in state and national politics. And of course, let's not forget that Iowa has the first caucus and presidential elections, right? Insurance companies are squeezing them on the insurance side. This is who's squeezing America's farmers, Wall Street and the banks. This is who's ruining Iowa's soil, which has been called black gold because it was some of the most fertile land in the world. American farmers receive $25 billion in federal farm subsidies, with 80% of it going to the top 10 private for-profit farm providers. Basically, they privatize the profit and nationalize the risks. An Iowa lawyer is quoted as saying, "This giant coastward, cityward shift of wealth, much more than mechanization, is why rural America is so bitter." All of this can be traced back to the financial services industry. Everyone is getting their cut except for the people who are doing the work. The people at the top of the pyramid are siphoning it off. Now, I can hear some bowtie dork saying, "Well, at least this means a cheaper product for consumers through efficiency and scale." Except it doesn't. Pork has not gotten much cheaper, and studies show that raising pigs in open pastures can generate similar or better per hog revenue than raising them in concentrated animal feeding operations. And Eichard estimates that retail food prices would be barely higher than they are today. Farmers, however, now get just 15 cents per dollar spent on food, compared with 31 cents per dollar that they would receive in the 1980s. Farmers are getting less, consumers are not paying less. That means there's a large hidden surplus of wealth being extracted from the system. To quote Nicholas Shaxson again, "To understand where that surplus is going, consider again that long value chain of agricultural wealth, but this time imagine it as a series of links made of strong but stretchy rubber, each link containing a certain amount of value. The players ranged along the chain all pull against each other to get as much for themselves as they can. Some firms merge or vertically integrate into bigger entities. They not only increase their reach along the chain, but bigger players have stronger muscles too, so they can grab even more. So monopoly will cascade through the chain. If one set of players merges into a bigger, stronger player, the others will feel the need to do likewise or get pulled out." So you remember Bayer, right? They sell aspirin, so many other things. Bayer is a German chemical company. They formed out of IG Farben, which was, among other things, using slave labor during World War II. Less well known, they were using slave labor during World War I as well. Anyway, in 2018, Bayer and Monsanto merged, which was a $66 billion merger. To do this merger, they used 5 law firms for different aspects of it. One of these law firms was Sullivan and Cromwell. Ding, 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 ding. In 2017, Dow Chemical and DuPont merged. In 2016, Syngenta was purchased by ChemChina. So, in economics, they have ways of calculating concentration ratios, right? Which quantify market concentration based on a company's market share in a given industry. It ranges, of course, from perfect competition all the way to complete monopoly. The difference, of course, being that this is actually quantifiable, you can calculate it. There are different ratios like the CR4 and CR8, but antitrust economists like to use the CR4 ratio to measure market concentration. And they generally consider a figure above 40% concentration to be a market that is highly concentrated. Do you want to care to guess what agriculture's CR4 ratio is currently at? It's at 82%, which is to say that agriculture is extremely highly concentrated. And this is not just for the people who own farms, right? Four global trading firms control 75% of the world grain market. This is also separate from Monsanto's whole innovations into proprietary seeds, things of this nature. All of this has led to massive concentrations of power in agriculture. Some people have raised fears of a Facebook of farming, which is a good time, I guess, to introduce the fact that Bill Gates now owns 269,000 acres of farmland, which is something he relatively recently got into. Could he be the upcoming Facebook of farming? Will he be a major player or the dominant player? Either way, we're headed for a monopoly. And now most of America's hog farming is foreign-owned. Smithfield Foods, the nation's largest pork producer, was bought by Shang Wei, now the WH Group, via Morgan Stanley's assistance and a $4 billion loan from the Chinese government. Functionally speaking, one out of every four pigs raised in the United States is substantially controlled by a company controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party, of course, knows how to use market power to harness political influence. I'm not pointing this out to do a Red Scare or anything, but I guess I bring it up to make Dungus mad, I guess. To make sense of all this, I must quote the great VI. Monopolist, capitalist combines, cartels, syndicates, and trusts divide among themselves, first of all, the whole internal market of a country, and impose their control, more or less completely, upon the industry of that country. But under capitalism, the home market is inevitably bound up with the foreign market. Capitalism long ago created a world market. A separate quote reads, "Crises of every kind, economic crises most frequently, but not only these, in their turn increase very considerably the tendency towards concentration and towards monopoly." Monopoly. This is the last word in the latest phase of capitalist development, but we shall only have a very insufficient, incomplete, and poor notion of the real power and the significance of modern monopolies if we do not take into consideration the part played by the banks. How true that is. So, what have we talked about today? Basically, US farmers were tricked into taking large amounts of credit. Then they had the rug pulled out from under them, ruining a huge number of farmers. Big business, backed by the banks, then moved in, and the feds ran interference with various controlled extremist movements on the back end. Then, chickenization was developed by the Tyson Food Company, and the financial shell games and shady accounting developed by the Vesti brothers was then integrated by Tyson. Chickenization and its accounting spread to cattle and pork, and it is now the dominant mode of animal farming. Chickenization is harmful to the animals, it's harmful to the farmers, it's harmful to the environment, to watersheds, even to property values. But it is not harmful to large farming cartels, insurance companies, and other upstream entities. Chickenization is very effective at sucking out surplus value. And who gets it? Insurance companies, big business, and the banks. These are the people choking out US farmers. Industrial animal factory farming and monocrop production are not just crimes against nature. They're economic crimes too. You could probably look at what happened to US farmers and take into account chickenization and financialization, and you could probably jerry-rig yourself halfway to some kind of organic U.S. Marxism, to be honest. Now, for sources today, of course, I used the great American novel The Sopranos, as well as two extremely good books by Nicholas Shaxson. The first book was The Finance Curse, How Global Finance is Making Us All Poorer, and the second book is Treasure Islands, Tax Havens and the Men Who Stole the World. Now, there's actually a pretty funny story about Nicholas Shaxson. He was unaware of this fact when he wrote the book Treasure Islands, where he has a long chapter about the Vesti brothers. But he didn't know that the Vesti brothers had crushed Nicholas Shaxson's great-great-uncle, who was a meat trader back in the day. He didn't know it at the time, but it's almost like he's getting his revenge by writing his books. Family history. It's all about family history, man. All history is family history. Then I also drew slightly from the book The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. And then I also pull some quotes from Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. Thank you for listening, dear listener. If you liked the bonus episode, just let people know. And again, it means a lot to me that you've subscribed. Thank you very much. I need to be on my way. I'll see you guys next episode. And God bless.
Feeds them all.